Okay, I'm going to start at 9 minutes past today. So let me start with this clicker question. So please do register with your clicker if you haven't done so already. So you'll remember last time we were talking about converting a non-deterministic finite automaton to a deterministic one. So for instance, we've got a non-deterministic finite automaton here. It's got three states. That means in principle, you know you can make a deterministic one with at most eight states that'll do the same job. So remember that states of the new DFA are possible sets of states of the original NFA. So that's probably all you need to remember to be able to do this. So the point is, you know you can do it with a machine with eight states, but in practice you don't need all eight of those states, because not all eight of those states will turn out to be reachable from the starting state. So the question is, if you try and design a DFA that accepts the same language as this, what's the minimum number of states you can get away with? So you might like to have a little scribble, play around, see if you can work one out, and then I'll start the clock. So I should say there's one obvious mistake you might make, which I made the first time, and that's you might forget to make sure that it's always possible for every state and every symbol. Got to make sure that there's always somewhere to jump to, okay? So there mustn't be any missing transitions. So that's something I forgot the first time around. So make sure your machine has that property. Okay. So perhaps if you look up and smile encouragingly once you think you have some sort of an answer to this. So, yeah, or put a sort of, yeah. Okay, a few. I'll give you a bit more time. Are you all doing this in your heads, by the way, don't see many of you. You're allowed to kind of write stuff if it helps. Okay. Quite impressive if you can do it in your heads. Okay, so we want a DFA that accepts the same language as this NFA. So see if I'll start the clock now. You still have 30 seconds to go. And make sure that it always has a place to jump to for any input symbol from any state. So here we go. This bit. I haven't told it what the right answer is, so. So it makes sense of that. Okay, it's got the two there, that means four. So 15 of you, if you're decoding this, 15 of you thought you need four states. 11 of you thought you need five states, and so on. Okay. I think you need five states. Okay. Let's see if we can. Okay. So here's my answer. So first of all, there were two A transitions. From the original state. So if we make those go to a single state now in this deterministic one, that should be an accepting state, because just A by itself should be allowed. And then you're allowed either any number of Bs or any number of Cs, but not a mixture. Okay. So once you've had a B, you know that you're only allowed Bs from then on. Once you've had a C, you're only allowed Cs from then on. And then finally, we need a garbage state for everything to go to if it hasn't got any other transitions to go to. So that's the thing I forgot. So if any transitions not accounted for on the main part of the diagram will take you into the garbage state, and once you're in the garbage state, you stay in the garbage state. Okay, so who reckons they came up with pretty much that idea? That's not bad, okay. Anyone have any question? Does anyone who thought differently want to kind of dispute or, yeah? Yeah. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. So yeah. So you can look it up on the web again if you want to go over that again. So while you've got your clickers in your hand, there's something else I want to do. And this is just a kind of, if I can work this, can I drag this? I see what I have to do. Yeah, I want to put the stuff away. Right. So now full screen that. And then, right, this is a consumer survey, right? Okay. So this is a clicker meta question. So just to help me give you optimum value, I want to ask you your opinion on the use of clickers. So what would you consider to be the optimum number of clicker questions in a lecture, in one lecture? Not counting silly meta-level questions like this one, okay? So a number of sensible questions. The one we've just done counts as a sensible question, okay? So I don't think I'm going to ever have the energy to do more than four, so you can vote for either 1, 2, 3, or 4 by pressing those numbers on your clicker. Or if you think there shouldn't be any clicker questions at all, then A, why have you bothered to get yourself a clicker? But you can vote for 0 by pressing 5. So we're working modulo 5 here, okay? So I guess you don't need too long to think about this, so I'll just, this will, okay, so, gosh. Okay, there's one person who hasn't answered yet. Who's registered? Okay. I'll just wait the remaining few seconds. How interesting. Okay. You like clicker questions. Yeah? Okay. You think they're okay. So okay. I'll write those numbers down. 4, 13, 3, 14, 2, 7. Okay, so three of you voted for no clicker questions at all, right? Okay. Fair enough. Thank you. Who would have voted for more than four if they'd had the chance? Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. Right, so back to... let's put this away for now. Back to this stuff. Right then. Okay, so just one more slide from the dead end, the tail end of last lecture. So we've talked about converting NFAs to DFAs. So we now know that it doesn't matter whether you work with NFAs or DFAs, you can define exactly the same class of languages either way. It gives the same class of regular languages. Okay. So I mentioned that there are some reasons why it's more convenient to work with NFAs. So just as a trivial example of a benefit we can reap from knowing this result, let's look at the following tiny little theorem. Okay. Let's assume we've got two regular languages over the same alphabet, L1 and L2. And remember, a language for us is just a set of allowable strings, okay? And the union of those two sets is also a regular language. So the language which can consist of either a string of L1 or a string of L2 is also a regular language, okay? Now you could prove that directly from the definition involving DFAs. So if you were given a DFA for L1 and a DFA for L2, it's possible, if you think about it, to cook yourself up a DFA that accepts exactly the language L1 union L2. But now that we know that we can use NFAs instead, point is, it's dead easy, because supposing N1 is an NFA that accepts accepts L1, and N2 is one that accepts L2, Each of these have various possible starting states. Remember, we're allowing a set of starting states in general. Okay. So what you can do is simply put these machines side by side and declare that a starting state for the combined machine can simply be any starting state from either of these two machines. Okay. So a course of computation for this machine will start off by non-deterministically jumping into one or other of these machines, and thereafter will behave as that machine. So it's obvious that a string is going to be accepted by this combined machine if and only if it's either accepted by N1 or N2. Okay? So all this stuff on the slide just says that same thing, except it says it in maths. So we've got N1 and N2, and I've said, let's assume the states of Q1 don't overlap with the states of Q2, because if they do, you can just relabel the states, call them something different. It's no big deal. Make them look different. And then you just take the unions of all the sets of states, the transition relation, and so on. You get a thing which corresponds to N1 and N2 side by side, like this. And clearly, this NFA recognizes exactly the union of those two languages. Okay. So that's something that's quite trivial in terms of NFAs, slightly less trivial in terms of DFAs. And this is also quite useful in practice, because if we want to build an automaton for a language which is made as a union of two smaller languages, we can do it here without an explosion in the number of states. If you were working with DFAs, you might have to sort of multiply the number of states of the two machines rather than add them together. So that's nice. And so now moving on to officially today's lecture, let's pretty much carry straight on from there. So this flows nicely, doesn't it? So we've just seen that if L1 and L2 are regular languages, then so is their union, L1 union L2. Okay. Now, in mathematical terminology, one sometimes expresses this by saying that the class of regular languages is closed under the union operation. That's just a sort of bit of mathematical jargon you'll quite often hear. And the way to understand that is you should think of the word closed in the sense of being self-contained. So if you've got a closed world or a closed universe, that's sort of the idea of a universe which, if you're inside it, there's no way to kind of jump outside it, because whatever you do, you sort of stay inside it. So idea is, if this is the big class of regular languages, and you're inside it, you've got various languages, you might sort of try to form new languages by taking the unions of those, but there's no way by just taking unions that you can escape from inside this class to one outside it. So that's the idea that's expressed by saying that this class is closed under the union operation. And what we're going to do, the first thing we're going to do today, is to show that actually this class of regular languages is closed under various other operations too. So there are various other operations which you can perform. And if the languages you start from are regular languages, the languages you end up with are regular languages. So, for example, we've got this operation, which I've written L1 dot L2, called concatenation of two languages. Now, the concatenation of two languages is basically a set of all strings that can be made up of some string from L1 followed by some string from L2. Okay, so it's natural to write that as just L1 followed by L2. Another operation which is important is one called Kleene star. So that little star there is Mr. Kleene's star. And so if L is any language, then L star basically is the language that consists of zero or more strings from L strung together. You okay? Yeah, okay. This language, for instance, will contain the empty string, because that's the empty string is what you get if you string together zero strings from L. It'll also contain every string from L itself. It'll also contain every string from L dot L. So that's if you take two strings already in L and string them together, and so on. So, for example, if L was the language that just consisted of the string A, then L star would consist of the empty string A, AA, AAA, and so on. And the point is that if L1 and L2 are known to be regular languages, then this concatenation will also be a regular language. And also, if L is known to be a regular language, then this Kleene star is known to be a regular language. So there are lots of useful operations we can perform on languages. And if the languages we start from are regular, we'll stay within the class of regular languages. So first of all, I hope to convince you of these two new closure properties. And to show these, I'll actually need to introduce just a very slight variation on the definition of NFAs that I've used so far. But it's not a big deal. It's not as big as the difference between NFAs and DFAs. And all that will lead us on nicely to yet another way of specifying regular languages, and that's via things called regular expressions, which I guess you saw a bit of in Inf 1. Did you use regular expressions? Yeah, good. Thanks. Okay. So we're working towards some closure properties. So I mentioned that we're just going to tweak the definition of NFAs a little bit. And again, this is something you might have seen. So we're going to slightly modify our notion of NFAs to allow some special kinds of transitions which are going to be marked with the Greek letter epsilon. Remember, epsilon is a symbol we're using to mean the empty string. So the idea is that epsilon is not itself a symbol in the alphabet you're using, but it's just an extra symbol you can use to label transitions, if you like. And the idea is that transitions labeled by epsilon are ones that the machine is free to perform any time it likes. You know, if it's starting in a state from which it can perform an epsilon transition, then it's free to do so, although it's not obliged to do so. It's free to perform these epsilon transitions without reading any symbol of the input. So in between the sort of real symbols that come from the alphabet, which trigger ordinary transitions, this also might be doing some sort of silent epsilon transitions on the quiet. Okay. So I hope it's intuitively clear that that's not going to make a very big difference. I'll show you on the next slide. It really doesn't make a difference. But it's quite handy to allow these things because, for example, we can do things like we can convert any NFA that we start off with to one that has exactly one starting state and exactly one final accepting state. Remember, in general, we're allowed a whole set of starting states in an NFA. But if you take a machine and put it in a box, and give yourself a new state which you declare to be the starting state, and then just epsilon transitions from there to all the states that were starting states in your original machine, the states in F, and then you also allow epsilon transitions from all the final states in your machine to some new state which you declare to be the one and only accepting state, then this can perform it. This can process any string your original machine can, because you start off in the starting state. You can just do an epsilon transition to the relevant proper starting state, do its stuff, then do an epsilon transition to the final state. So it's just a useful device that kind of simplifies the way of drawing. It simplifies the way of writing a lot of NFAs if you allow these extra epsilon transitions in. Okay. Now, in principle, we've made our class of machines bigger by allowing these epsilon transitions. We've got a bigger class of machines. But I hope it's reasonably clear that this doesn't fundamentally change the power of non-deterministic finite automata. And indeed, you can think of an epsilon NFA in a way as just a convenient way of writing an ordinary NFA. So the point is, if we've got a machine now that's one of these epsilon NFAs that allows these epsilon transitions, you can think about turning it into an ordinary NFA by saying, well, supposing our epsilon machine can do an A transition here, and let's suppose it can also do some epsilon transitions before and after it. Okay. So supposing we just sort of expand our definition of the transition to relation so as to consider this as just a single A transition of some new machine. So in other words, we reinterpret transitions so as to allow for this silent transitions going on at the same time, going on in between stuff. So in that way, you can take any NFA that might have epsilon transitions, turn it into one that doesn't, but that accepts just the same language, just because you allow you make your transition steps a bit bigger to sort of build in the possibility of epsilon transitions. So there's a little bit more scary maths that says that here. So if we've got a transition relation for an epsilon machine, okay, then we can sort of fatten it out to a transition relation delta bar, which sort of starts from everything you've got in the original one and then allows you to add epsilons at either end and says if you do that, you get something that's still in delta bar. Likewise, if we've got a set of starting states, we'd better expand that to allow us new starting states, all the ones that you can get to from old starting states by doing an epsilon transition. So the point is for an NFA with epsilon transitions, we can convert it to an NFA without epsilon transitions. That's equivalent in the sense it defines the same language. So it's no big deal. It's just a convenience that we allow these epsilon transitions. But now that we've allowed them, it's quite convenient because we can show various properties. So I've mentioned that I've got this concatenation operation here. So L1 dot L2 is the set of all languages consisting of a string from L1 followed by a string from L2. And I've said that if L1 and L2 are themselves regular languages, then this is a regular language. Okay? How can we show this? Well, now we can see it quite easily, because if these are regular languages, then there must be NFAs that accept exactly them. So let me draw them like this, N1 and N2. And by what I had on the slide two slides ago, I can assume, if I'm allowing epsilon transitions, I can assume that N1 and N2 themselves have just one start state and one finishing state, which I've drawn on the left and the right, one start state, one finishing state. So assume they have that property. And then I just hook them up like this by sticking an epsilon transition between them. Okay? So if now I give it any string of the form XY, where X is in L1, Y is in L2, then processing X will get me somehow or other from here to here. And then I can just silently do an epsilon transition, and then processing Y will get me to this state. And now I label this as the only accepting state for the resulting machine. So it's pretty clear that this gives you a machine that will accept exactly this concatenated language, L1, L2.
Yeah.
Okay. Question you might like to ask yourself, do we actually need this little epsilon transition here? Or would it be enough to kind of squunge those two things together and just use a single state at the interface, so make the final state of this one the same as the initial state of that one? As I've stated on this, as I've stated it here, the answer is actually no. You couldn't get away with that. You do actually need this, but you might want to ponder why that's the case. Okay. And now here's another fun thing we can do. So that shows that we've shown that our class of regular languages is closed under concatenation. Let's also show that it's closed under this Kleene star. So remember, L star is the language that consists of zero or more, any number of strings from L, all concatenated. Okay, so for example, if I just had this simple language with two strings here, AAA and B, then I can have a string made from B and then AAA and then B. Okay, so for a string to be in L dot L dot L, it doesn't have to be the same string three times, it can be three different strings. So we allow repetitions of things. So once again, supposing we've got a machine N, and I'll assume, which I can assume has one start state and one finishing state. Okay? And now, I just make it into another machine by now allowing a starting state here, which is also an accepting state, and that will mean that the empty string is accepted, because we're in accepting state straight away. Okay? And then, we can go around this loop once or twice or as many times as we like. Okay? By processing strings from N, and this thing will, anytime we've kind of done some number of strings from the language L, we'll end up again in this accepting state here, so we'll allow such a string. So again, this corresponds to the language L star, and that shows that class of regular languages is closed under cleanly start as well. So this class of regular languages is turning out to have quite a lot of closure properties. Okay? And that's good, because that means we've got lots of freedom of ways of constructing new regular languages from old ones, or more complicated ones from less complicated ones. And in fact, there's even more than that. So in the next lecture, I'll give you just a few more closure properties, which will give us a kind of very rich bunch of machinery for building up regular languages. But let's just see what we can do with it for now. So what I've shown you so far is cunningly chosen to be exactly what we need to talk about regular languages in terms of regular expressions. So remember that so far we've been thinking about regular languages as specified primarily by machines, be they DFAs or NFAs. We've been using those as our primary means of defining a language. And machines, as you've seen, are quite often specified by giving little diagrams of them. And that's all very nice, and diagrams are quite intuitive and easy to understand. But it's also handy to have more text-based ways of specifying a regular language. So for example, if you want to actually process, do something involving a regular language on a computer, if you actually want to, to process the definition of a regular language in some ways, it's quite useful to have something that's a bit more like a programming language or a language for writing definitions of regular languages in. Okay, so we're actually going to be talking about languages on two levels here, because we've got the language of regular expressions is actually a language for defining languages. Try not to get too confused by that. So regular expressions are a text-based way of writing down definitions of regular languages. What is a regular expression? Well, a regular expression is a written expression, so it's a written mathematical thing. It's built up from certain basic kinds of regular expressions. So I've got empty set and epsilon. They're basic regular expressions. You'll notice if you look carefully that these are sort of boldface empty set and epsilon things. So that's just to emphasize that these are written symbols, empty set and epsilon, rather than denoting the empty string or the actual mathematical empty set. These are part of a written language. And we also allow a basic regular expression, just the letter A for any letter A in our alphabet. So these things are your kind of atomic regular expressions that you start off with. And from those, we allow ourselves to build up more complicated regular expressions by repeatedly applying three operations. So we've got operation plus, dot, and times. And dot and times, dot and star, I should say, they're going to correspond exactly to the operations dot and star for concatenation and cleanly star that I've just shown you. Plus is going to correspond to union of languages, but it's in this context it's traditionally written as plus, just to confuse you. So get used to that. So plus and dot are binary operations because we can take two languages and combine them, and star is a unary operation, so it will just apply to one thing. So, for example, by repeatedly applying those operations to our basic set of regular expressions, we can build up regular expressions like this. A dot B plus epsilon, and then star all that, and then plus that with A. So that's just a bit of written gobbledygook that we're allowed to write. And we'll allow ourselves the use of brackets to indicate priority. So here I've indicated that the whole of this is starred rather than just the epsilon. But there are some conventions that say that if we don't write brackets, then star binds more tightly than dot, which itself binds more tightly than plus. So if I write something like this, then this star here attaches itself just to the A here rather than to anything bigger. Think of this star as clumping together with the A first, and then the B dot as clumping together with that, and then finally the A plus gets added. And also, we quite often omit the dot, just like you would ordinarily, quite often, if you wrote a dot for multiplication in ordinary algebra, you'd quite often omit that and write A times B. So these are regular expressions. They're just mathematical expressions you can write. But the idea is that these expressions are supposed to be understood as ways of defining certain languages. So let's see, how does a regular expression define a language? So here we see how to any regular expression we can associate an actual language. So regular expression itself is just a written expression. An actual language, remember, is a set of strings, okay, a set of legal strings. And as you might expect, this empty set symbol is a way of defining the empty language, okay, and this is the language that has no valid strings, legal strings at all. And the epsilon symbol is the language consisting of just the empty string. So do not confuse this language with this language, okay? This is the language that doesn't contain any strings at all. This is a language that contains exactly one string, but it's the empty string. It's a string that doesn't contain any symbols. So there is a distinction there you need to be aware of. And the language associated with A is just the set that consists of just one string, and that string itself consists of just one symbol, and that symbol is A. Okay? So those are some really, really primitive languages, kind of, you know, Stone Age or even before that. And then we've got these operations plus, dot, and star for building up more complicated regular expressions from simpler ones. And plus is interpreted as the union of the two languages defined by the two sides. And as I said before, dot is interpreted by dot. So this is the symbolic dot in our language of regular expressions. This is the dot for concatenation of languages that I've shown you earlier. Similarly here for Kleene star. Okay. So a little example, this A plus B A star will define this language, because this plus means union, so we've got just A here, that's the only string in this language. And then we've got B followed by zero or more A's, so there's B, BA, BAA, BAA, and so on. Okay, so any little regular expression like this will define a language, okay? So try not to be too confused by the fact that regular expressions are themselves written in some language, okay, which we can think of as a kind of meta-language. The language of regular expressions isn't itself actually a regular language. It'll actually be a good example of a context-free language, which we'll come on to. But try and kind of keep this in the background of your minds for now. So we'll concentrate on the object languages that we're defining with regular expressions. Okay. Now, straight away from what we've said so far, we've got these primitive languages here, and it's pretty easy to see that each of these is a regular language. You can write down a thing with about one state, probably, for each of that defines each of these. Maybe two states, actually. Right? And we've also seen that the union of two regular languages is a regular language, the concatenation of two regular languages is regular, and the Kleene star of a regular language was regular. So if you think about what that means that every language that you can define using a regular expression is a regular language. Okay, so it's not just coincidence that these are called regular expressions. Okay, so you can see that just because as you build up your regular expression, you're just performing these operations repeatedly, and all the time we stay within our class of regular languages. If you want to prove that really formally, you can prove it this by induction on the size of regular expressions. So for every regular expression, it's built out of smaller regular expressions. So if you already know that every regular expression of size at most 5 defines a regular language, you can show that every regular expression of size at most 6 and then 7 defines a regular language, and so on. Okay. So because we've got these closure properties of the class of regular expressions, we know every regular expression you can write down defines a regular language. Ah, clickers again, right. So, okay, remember, this is a language we've talked about several times before. The language consisting of strings that contain an even number of zeros. Remember, we had a little two-state machine that recognizes that language. Now, there are many different regular expressions you could write down to define that language. They're by no means a unique regular expression. And, in fact, all of these except one of these is a permissible way of defining this language, okay? So your question is, which of these regular expressions is not a way of defining that language? Okay. Hang on. There might be more. Okay. I did something I didn't mean to. I just need to check whether that. Okay, there are two of these that don't define. There's a typo somewhere. Okay, so you can choose either one. I think there are two of these, but. Right. Okay. Let's start the clock then. Interesting. Okay, so number three was the answer I had in mind. So 15 of you got that. So let's look at three. So why does this indeed not define? Right, I need to go back here. This one doesn't define the language in question because. Sorry, okay, it doesn't define the language in question, but for a much more stupid reason than the one I had. Okay, I need to check these more carefully. Okay, neither two nor three actually said what I intended it to say. Okay, why don't I? Right. Okay, let's just do this more interactively. So, supposing I had written. You're right that three doesn't define the language in question, because here we're only allowing strings with two zeros, okay? Not with zero, not with new zeros, and not with four zeros. What I've meant to write, that was much better star there. Okay. Now, would this define the language in question? You think it would? Okay. Anyone think it wouldn't? So it's more plausible, but I think it wouldn't, because you see, you can have any number of currencies of this, but by the time after, supposing you had four zeros, this doesn't let you insert a one between the second zero and the third zero. Yeah. You agree? So that's the okay. That was meant to be kind of the real content of the question, that you were meant to spot that. Unfortunately, rather obscured by various other glitches on the slide. Okay. Not many of you voted for two. So who thinks two would does define the language in question? No. What would be an example to show that it didn't? Sorry? Zero, zero. Yeah, okay. So I'd meant to write it actually with a one star there to allow zero ones there. But this says if you've got some zeros, then it's forcing you to put a one after it, which isn't what we want. Okay. Now, a lot of you were of the opinion that this last one So number four got quite a few votes, right? Which means quite a few of you thought that number four doesn't define the language in question. So does anyone have an example to show that? Who now thinks it does define the language in question? Okay. So it's a different, I mean, what's interesting is that these do correspond to different ways of thinking about the language. So the point is that here we've got the idea that we can chop a language up into bits. But once we've had a zero, so a bit can be just a one, and we can have as many ones as we like. But once we've had a zero, we're committed to having another zero eventually. Okay, so we can't stop until we've had another zero. So imagine we've got a string of zero of ones and zeros, and just imagine you sort of chop it up where you've got pairs of zeros. You just sort of make them units like that, and then each unit and each of the ones in between is a sort of unit here. That gives you another way of doing it. Okay. Hope you got something of the feel of it through that process, even though I apologize for getting a question seriously wrong. Okay, how are we doing? Right, okay. So I've shown you that every regular expression defines a regular language, and that's because of these closure properties that we discussed earlier. But it's even better than that, because the converse is also true. So every regular language can also be defined as by a regular expression. So if you put those two facts together, you've got the result known as Kleene's theorem, which says that DFAs and regular expressions give rise to exactly the same classes of languages. So the languages you can define as DFAs are exactly the same as the languages you can define with regular expressions, namely the class of regular languages. Okay, and we've already seen, so now we've got three ways of defining regular languages, because we've already seen that NFAs, or four ways if you allow NFAs, ordinary NFAs, and NFAs with epsilon transitions, whichever of these ways you choose, you arrive at the same class of languages. So the evidence is kind of mounting that this is a class of languages that are really important class, because there are lots of different ways of varying the definition or even choosing definitions of in quite different spirit, which land you up with the same class of regular languages. So that suggests that this class of regular languages is something that just keeps popping up. Okay, so it's can be defined mathematically in lots of ways, and so it's really worth understanding. So I've proved the first half of this. I'm going to go on and show you why the more difficult half is true, why it's true that every regular language can be defined by a regular expression. So that's the remaining part of Kleene's theorem. So let's indicate why this is true. Okay, so we've got it. Supposing we're given a regular language, and let's suppose we're given some NFA for it, and it's an NFA without epsilon transitions. We're going to show how, from the structure of this NFA, it's possible to build up a regular expression that defines exactly the language in question. And actually, I'm going to do this in two different ways. This first way is a way that's kind of quite general. It's quite easy to see that it works in principle, so this is quite clear as a proof that there is some regular expression that works. It's not the best way to do it in practice. So if you actually, in practice, wanted to compute some regular expression matching a given NFA or a given DFA, there's a better way to do it, but then it's less clear that it's always going to work. Okay. So if it's the theorem we want, then this is the version you want to use. If you actually want to do it, then it's the other version. Okay. So we're going to get to this in stages. We're going to construct a whole family of different regular expressions. So this will be for here's our NFA. So for any pair of states U and V, okay, and any set X of possible states, so here's X of possible states, okay, I'm going to think about ways of getting
ways of getting from U to V, okay, such that all intermediate states we visit, if we visit any intermediate states, all intermediate states have to lie in X. We don't have to visit all the states in X, but we're not allowed to visit any states that don't lie in X. So the point is, I'm going to perform quite a sophisticated construction which assigns to every choice of U and V and every choice of a set X, which might or might not contain U or V, we're going to assign a regular expression, which is going to be an expression that defines the language of ways of getting from U to V via states in X. And then at the end of the day, what we're interested in is when X is the set of all states. Okay, so if X is the set of all states, then it will just give us all ways of getting from U to V. And if U is some start state and V is some final state of the original NFA, then that will be defining part of the language for the whole of this NFA. And in fact, if we consider then every combination of starting states and finishing states, and we sum together all of these regular expressions, where for this X here we've got the set Q of all states, that'll be a regular expression for the set of all strings that are accepted by the original NFA. So we solve this problem by actually giving ourselves a much bigger problem of constructing not just one regular expression, but this whole massive family of them. The reason it's easier is because we can build up these regular expressions by working our way from smaller sets X to larger sets X. So we do this first by considering the case where X is just the empty set, so ways of getting from U to V without going through any intermediate states at all. And then we can consider ways of getting to U to V where we do allow just one possible intermediate state, and then ways where we allow two intermediate states, and so on, and we build it up and up until we allow any intermediate state. So that's the shape of the construction, and just got time to take you through a slide which tells us how to do it. So I've said we start off in the case by thinking about what happens when X is empty, okay? So what's a regular expression for the ways of getting from U to V? So without going through any intermediate states, okay? So let's assume, first of all, that U and V are different states. So then we just have to look at our NFA and see what transitions are there that take us directly in one hop from U to V, okay? So supposing we had A1 to AK are the transitions that do that. Then if we allow, give ourselves this expression A1 plus A2 dot, dot, dot plus AK, that'll be a language, that'll define the language of ways of getting from U to V without any intermediate states, okay? If our U and V are actually the same state, there's a little subtlety that we should also add the null, the language consisting of the null sequence here, because we could get from U to itself just by not doing anything, yeah? Just by staying where we are, or by doing some self-transition if there is one, okay? And then, and this is the kind of clever bit, supposing X isn't the empty state, so supposing we've got set X, which is some smaller set Y, together with an element, new state Q, that's not in X. And now I'm looking at ways of getting from U to V via a sequence of states that are all in X, okay? Now I want to break this down by considering separately the cases where these states are states in Y and whether they're the state Q. So if we've got anywhere at all of getting from U to V where all the intermediate states are states in X, let's think about marking the ones which are Qs, okay? So supposing we visit Q three times here, okay? So we've got three Qs. And all the states we visit between these queues, or on the way to and from these queues, are not themselves queues, so all these other ones are states in Y. Okay. So here, we have a way of getting from U to Q via states in Y. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So you can see, if we can get from U to Q via stating Y, and then we can get from Q to itself any number of times we like, also via stating Y, so we've got the language that gets from Q to Q via stating Y. We star it so as to allow zero or more sections of this kind, and then finally we've got to get back to V again via just states in Y. Okay? And then there's one other possibility, which is that we didn't visit Q at all, okay? So we don't need to go to Q at all, so we've just got the way of ways of getting from U to V via states in Y. So you can see that this once we've got regular expressions for these simpler things involving this smaller state Y, we can get a regular write down a regular expression for the thing we want. So applying this repeatedly for starting from the empty set X and then with one element sets and two element sets and so on, we can get all these sets we want. So there's just a little example on this slide, which I haven't really got time to do now. So this is our familiar two-state machine for even sequences. If you apply this procedure here, we get, so we're interested in the ways of getting from P to P via allowing any intermediate states. And you can see you can break it down like this, and each of these can be broken down even further. And you get a regular expression here, which is hopefully correct, but is even more messy than any of the regular expressions for this language that I gave, and any of the correct ones I gave on the clicker slide. So it's a messy way to do it. It works, and it's sort of mathematically clear that in principle it will always work. So that gives you your proof that every language that's definable by an NFA is definable by some regular expression. So just be a bit more to do on a more start next tomorrow's lecture on a more practical way of doing that, and then we'll look at some applications of all this theoretical stuff. And also, tomorrow's lecture, I'll give out the copies of tutorial sheet 1. So,
hi. First of all, thank you for offering me a job as a tutor for this course.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry, you are.
I'm Jensen.
Oh, right. Okay, hi.
I wonder if I could get the tutorial sheet and the solution for the tutorial, first tutorial.
Yes, I'll be sending them out tomorrow.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Thank you very much.
Oh no, I'm not collecting any data for it or anything like that. No, it's just completely. I'm not. You can do things like that, but I'm not using it for anything. It's completely anonymous. Regard it as completely anonymous. Oh right, okay. I should maybe. Yeah, so not everyone has them. So, yeah, it's just for fun. No, so relax about that.
I just have a suggestion. If you want to increase the time in the clicker question.
Oh, right. Would a bit longer be helpful?
Yeah, you can press the plus button right next to
okay. Are you saying you'd like more time? Or?
No, because I noticed you give us 30 seconds at first and then you start it. And then the first 30 seconds we can't register any answers.
So okay, but you don't. You're saying you want longer to.
Some questions require more time. And
okay, so I start it when I think.
No, I mean you can press the start button, the plus.
Yeah, I know you. I know you can, but I'm just asking.
Oh.
Are you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you saying it's better if I do that?
No, I just.
Did you weren't sure if I knew whether.
No, I thought you didn't know about.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. I sort of know that there's. And lots of things, lots
can
of things.
Can you also put it on full screen? Because in the back I can't see the.
Oh, right, I thought it was on full screen though.
No, press the.
Yeah, but that's the Beamer. Yeah, that's Beamer stuff. Okay, maybe there are two notions of full screen. So it's okay. It's on full screen from the point of view of the PDF viewer, but maybe there's.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
okay. Is there an even full? If there's an even fuller screen, I can.
Yeah, I think there is.
You think there is? Okay. Okay. I'll try that.
Oh,
thanks.
Thank you very much.